Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Good to have you with us this morning. It's Monday. And as we have done each Monday since the pandemic was declared, this is an hour that is all about the science of this new coronavirus. As we take your calls and questions, I'll be asking our guests about whether the virus is still not mutating and what that means for a vaccine, why finding drug therapy seems to be so difficult. We just heard some news about that. And what is actually involved in expert contact tracing? So two guests and your questions too. What do you want to know about protecting yourself and your family? What are you curious about when it comes to testing? I'd imagine we all have a lot of questions about that. How do you feel about the idea of opening more businesses in Minnesota and the upper Midwest? So just questions on the overall science of where we're at in this pandemic. What are you curious about when it comes to testing? How do you feel about this idea of opening more businesses in Minnesota and the upper Midwest? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can reach me on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Dr. Angela Hewlett is with us, medical director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit and associate medical director of infection control and epidemiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And with us today from Omaha, Dr. Hewlett, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Dr. Preethi Malani is with us, University of Michigan's chief health officer and a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Michigan Medicine, and with us today from Ann Arbor. And Dr. Malani, welcome. Good to have you on the show as well.
Good to be here. Thank you, Carrie.
Dr. Malani, I'm going to ask you both about this. I know that there were some pretty serious hot spots in Michigan. How do things look today, particularly in Ann Arbor?
So, Carrie, I'm happy to report that things are looking a lot better in Ann Arbor, and it's each day seems like a year, but just a few weeks ago. Yes, just a few weeks ago, things did not look as good, but thankfully, with all of our fellow Michiganders working hard to stay home and to practice physical distancing, things have definitely settled down, particularly in Ann Arbor, and our hospital is starting to think about getting back to doing some more elective things.
Oh, wow. That is good news. Wow. Dr. Hewlett, I was reading something that you have said about Nebraska over the weekend. You said that if you look at the overall number of cases throughout the state, it looks like you're doing pretty well. But when you break it down by counties, you said that you really start to get a truer picture and that, quote, it's alarming. So how does it look this morning? And tell me why you're alarmed about what you're seeing there.
Well, that's definitely the case here in Nebraska. I mean, if you look at our case numbers, we have a little over 3,000 cases and 52 deaths throughout the state. But that being said, there are definitely some hot spots in Nebraska, particularly in some of our rural counties, that are alarming to see the numbers. And you know, in fact, we actually, one of our rural counties has about, I think it's a little over 800 cases,
wow.
whereas their whole county has a population of around 60,000, whereas in Douglas County, which is where Omaha is situated, we have a population of around 500,000, yet we only have 400 some odd cases. So they're essentially double what we are here in our metro area. And they're a very rural area, but unfortunately, they have several things going against them. They have an outbreak in one of the meatpacking plants there, actually several around the area, as well as issues in long-term care facilities, and now a significant amount of community spread. So this is something that is not, if you look at our numbers, statewide, we look pretty good, but there are definitely some areas that are concerning in our state.
So when you said we have things working against us, you're talking about people standing side by side in the meatpacking plant, people working in these congregate centers, right, where we know that this disease spreads pretty quickly. And so when you really start to break down how the virus is spreading, I can see why you say this is pretty alarming.
Exactly. These are areas in particular, you know, these rural communities, the jobs there often serve very essential functions, food processing, pharmacy, you know, farming and, you know, power plants, that sort of thing. And so what happens is, you know, these are not typical work from home industries. So they're not industries where people can telecommute or call in from home. They're industries where people have to show up to work in order to produce our food supply. And so, and they're also industries that do work in very close contact. So, you know, often shoulder to shoulder, which makes things, you know, it creates a problem when you're talking about a virus that's spread person to person.
All right. Dr. Malani, I want to ask you something about what the CDC said this morning. They have increased the number of symptoms that they are saying that medical personnel and, of course, average Americans have to be aware of, along with fever, cough, shortness of breath. They are now adding 6 new conditions: chills, repeated shaking with chills, muscle pain, headache, sore throat, and new loss of taste or smell. Would you tell me why it's important, I guess, that the CDC would put out this new list of symptoms? I mean, what is it that I guess we should understand about that?
Yeah, so Carrie, it's interesting. Is each day, like we talked about, how each day feels like a year, not just in the amount of things that are happening locally, but also in what we're learning clinically about COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that strikes me is just how different people are presenting. And as testing is ramped up, I mean, again, if you just go back even a few weeks, testing was really focused on people who presented to the hospital who were sick,
right.
Or healthcare workers who had symptoms, and we really focused on sort of more traditional respiratory issues, shortness of breath and cough and fever were prominent. But as there's been more testing on minimally symptomatic people or even asymptomatic people, and particularly in some of the settings that Dr. Hewlett mentioned, like in care facilities, we're finding that there's a whole range, and it could be very minor things. One of the points that you mentioned is super interesting, which is that the loss of sense of smell and taste, which is being described. And again, it's such a specific
right.
symptom. If you ask someone whether they have that, they can tell you yes or no. And part of it is that as we're thinking about getting people back to work and back to some type of normalcy, and even though it won't look quite the same, are there ways to try to screen so that we help prevent people from coming into contact with a lot of people who might have very mild symptoms?
And Dr. Hewlett, we had an updated recommendation here from Dr. Deborah Birx, who said, I think Friday or over the week, I guess she said this on Meet the Press, now that I think about it, yesterday, that she believes social distancing may be necessary all through the summer, even though she acknowledges that, you know, states are going to open in different ways and in different phases. Georgia's already largely open. Do you agree with that? Do you think that we are going to be observing these social distancing instructions much of the summer?
I do agree with that. I think that, you know, we will be observing some element of social distancing for a while, and it may even last further than the summer. We really don't know what's going to happen with this. And, social distancing is the most effective way to prevent the transmission of this virus. And so, you know, we are seeing some effects of that. As Dr. Malani mentioned, you know, we're seeing some, I think, good effects of that here in Omaha, and the fact that, you know, our curve has been somewhat, you know, flattened a bit, and we haven't overwhelmed our healthcare systems here, at least in our metro area, probably due to those social distancing efforts that have been made. But, you know, when things start to open up, and as you mentioned, that's happening now, even here in Nebraska, relatively soon, we have to be very strategic about this, and we have to do it in the right way. And social distancing is definitely part of that.
Dr. Angela Hewlett with us, Medical Director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit, and Dr. Preethi Malani, University of Michigan's Chief Health Officer. We asked them, as we do on Mondays, to join us to field some of the latest questions and the new knowledge about what's happening with this pandemic, but also to answer some of your questions. I'm interested in whether you are curious about, and some of this is conflicting information about testing. I mean, have you, as a Minnesotan, as somebody who lives in the upper Midwest, felt like you wanted to get tested? Now are you wondering how to get that done and which test might be most valuable? Because there's a number of different methods. And then I'd also like to know how you feel, again, here in the upper Midwest, about the idea of opening more businesses in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. Do you feel like you are confident that we're ready to do this? So your questions on the science of the pandemic, about testing, about the idea of opening more businesses, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Dr. Hewlett, we got a call from Linda in St. Paul who says, my daughter is pregnant with twins. She has a 3-year-old. I'm 69. Can our whole family get tested so we know if we are coronavirus free so I can stay with her when she's scheduled to give birth? This would be kind of, I guess, trying to prove a negative, right? Like, are we safe to do this? We have no symptoms. Are we eligible for testing?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And really that situation, you know, obviously is being encountered a fair amount in the community, especially with childbirth. You know, that's a situation where you obviously want to have people around you helping you, you know, during that process. Really the way that people have been, you know, determining testing of asymptomatic individuals actually varies between facilities. So for instance, wherever this person plans to deliver the baby may have a protocol in place for family members. They may allow visitors. They may not. Those things are, you know, we mentioned these things are kind of morphing day by day or hour by hour. And so it would be very important for her to discuss this actually with her, her physician or her care provider there, wherever she'll deliver, to determine what their current protocol is for testing and whether they would allow visitors in that delivery area. But again, this is a very common thing at hospital visitors, you know, other visitors to the healthcare facilities. But for the most part, facilities have been taking this on in different ways. So it'd be important to go ahead and talk for them to talk specifically to their facility on which way that they recommend.
While we're talking about testing, Dr. Malani, we seem to be getting some conflicting information about this antibody testing. And there's some new technology coming online here in Minnesota and other parts of the country. You hear one expert say, well, that's not the all clear. You know, you can't just count on that's 100%, you're good to go. And then we hear others say, well, that's a very valuable marker to decide who's already had it or who's still vulnerable. How much faith do you put in the antibody testing?
You know, so Carrie, this is again an evolving question, and as you note, some of the issues around serology are problematic, and I personally have gotten a number of emails from friends and neighbors who are trying to get in on the serology business, and I've heard estimates that there are, you know, 80 different companies, maybe more.
Wow.
that are looking to have a product. And you know, my understanding, and Dr. Hewlett may know more about this, is that it's sort of right now a little bit of a free-for-all where people are, they have these kits and they're just testing people. And the bottom line is that probably the prevalence of infection or recent infection in the communities is lower than what we might think. And again, it's going to be different in New York City than it might be in Omaha. But even with the sensitivity specificities, the idea that if you've had infection, you'll have a positive test. And if you haven't, you have a negative test. Even in the high 90%, it might not be adequate because it's not a very common process in the community yet. And then you hit on another issue, which is that we don't really know what immunity means.
Mm-hmm.
Although we're hopeful that people don't get ill twice, we're not certain, and we can measure the responses in this case, it's called the IgM and IgG response. But we don't fully know because there hasn't been enough experience in humans. There is some testing that's been done in a small number of non-human primates that does suggest protection. But we're going to learn more about this issue in the coming weeks. I will say that if you asked me a month ago, I would have thought that, oh, serology is going to be very important in terms of getting back to work and getting back to school.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm less enthusiastic about it at this moment.
Really? So as this has gone on, you've thought, well, that may be exactly the kind of information we need, and now it's getting a little murkier, huh?
Yeah, it is murky, and again, because there's so many different products, that the standard isn't there. And in terms of how you're going to use it,
mm-hmm.
real time, and whether it's having someone come to visit a care facility or to visit their pregnant daughter in the hospital, is not quite clear to me.
Let me take a call here from Janet in Bemidji. Hi, Janet. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My question was about living in a rural area and suspecting that there will be a point when different small hospitals and their ICUs might be filled up. Is there a system that's just been established so that people know maybe the next best place to go or can be easily referred to places like, for me, I could look at perhaps the need to go to a metro area such as Duluth or Grand Forks or Fargo.
Yeah, Janet, this is such a good question. I don't know if you saw the piece in the Times over the weekend about how many Americans live, you know, 30 minutes or more from a hospital. So I'm really glad you asked. Dr. Hewlett, that seems like a good one for you.
Sure. Well, so first of all, there are protocols already existing in place for smaller hospitals to transfer to larger hospitals for higher level of care. And that's way before COVID. So if you had, you know, a severe illness that a small hospital either, you know, couldn't handle or didn't feel comfortable, you know, dealing with, they often transfer those patients to, you know, to larger hospitals, you know, even if they're many, many miles away for a higher level of care. And that's exactly what's happening in this scenario. We have this in Nebraska where we have some of our small hospitals, small rural hospitals that are filled. Their ICUs are filled right now with COVID patients. And so they have been transferring patients to other facilities. Now, that being said, if you're having an emergency, like if you are very, very sick and you need to, you know, you're calling 911 or you want to go, you know, quickly to an ER, you still should go to that small facility, even if they're full. They will figure out a way, typically in their emergency department, to get you care temporarily until they can transfer you elsewhere. You know, I don't want people driving hundreds of miles to other healthcare facilities, you know, if they're having an emergent situation. But do know that even in those small facilities that are full or that, you know, that have limited capabilities, they definitely have the capability to transfer elsewhere. And that's been going on for years prior to the COVID outbreak.
You know, Dr. Milani, one of the things that piece in the Times, I think it was the Times, not the Post, over the weekend said, is that rural hospitals are also in some pretty serious financial trouble because in order to prepare for COVID patients, rightly so, you know, they stopped all of the other procedures that often kind of keep them afloat. I wonder what you're seeing in Michigan and some of the more rural parts of the state.
Yeah, so Michigan is a very diverse state, and there are many parts of the state where there are not hospitals and not ICU beds, certainly at the county level. And so we have a similar system with the Michigan Hospital Association. And there was a lot of discussion, and there still is, although things have settled down, around making sure that hospitals had good communications and ability to transfer, particularly the most critical patients. But, Kerry, your point is well taken, and it's not just smaller hospitals, it's not just more rural hospitals that are taking a major hit financially because of the revenue generating procedures tend to be the surgeries and the endoscopies, and those have been on hold for a number of reasons, not just for bed capacity, but because of the need for personal protective equipment. The capacity to absorb that is going to be smaller at a smaller hospital, but I will share that it's not unique to small hospitals, but a large university hospital is going to just have more ability, more resilience in that way.
Okay. Call here from Yvonne in South St. Paul. Hey, Yvonne. Hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to ask us?
So I work in an essential retail business, and my concern is a lot about, has a lot to do with contact tracing.
Sure.
And how are we able to do that? How are we doing that? And if more businesses open up, then more people potentially exposed through different chains of contact. And then one of those people at one of those businesses that reopens comes into mine,
mm-hmm.
could potentially transmit the disease to me. And now I'm transmitting it to the dozen, two dozen, three dozen people I interact with at my essential business because I can't shut down.
Yeah, really good question.
I'm wondering, how do we track all that?
Great, because I really wanted to get into contact tracing here. Dr. Milani, I'm aware that I think Los Angeles tried to do this at the very beginning of the pandemic, do as much contact tracing as they could. And then they had to give up because there were, you know, more urgent things to turn to. How can we do this on some kind of massive scale? And do you think that's what it's going to take before we really have a handle on this pandemic?
Yeah, so contact tracing, like the name implies, is reaching out and contacting people who have been in contact with someone. And again, the workplace is a good example, and there are other examples. You know, this is complicated because our public health infrastructure doesn't have enough people to do the kind of tracing that would be needed. And there have been a number of different ideas that have been floated. There have been a number of volunteers. I know in my state, I heard there were several thousand a lot of them were health sciences students who signed up to be contact tracers. It was something they could do virtually and remotely while some of their classes are on hold. But it feels to me today, Carrie, that this is going to have to leverage technology. And again, within Washtenaw County, where I live, early on in the epidemic, our health department did a great job of trying to do the contact tracing and calling people and checking to see who lives with them and who works with them. But as people start to get much more mobile, first of all, they don't necessarily know who they've interacted with.
Right.
And it gets at interesting ethical issues around privacy.
For
but,
sure.
You know, if you think about the university setting, for example, where it's impossible to fully socially distance, and this is going to be a big topic for the fall, and whether universities can really get back on track. But, you know, is that something where you could leverage technology and then have additional people to help with that contact tracing? And as we learn more about what kind of exposures are the highest risk ones, you know, is it just a few minutes sitting next to somebody or is it the household exposures that we think about?
Yeah, Dr. Hewlett, I was thinking as Dr. Milani was raising some of the ethical issues here, you know, China, I know, is using technology, using phones, and they're designating people through their phones as to whether they have, you know, they have what they believe is immunity or whatever. I can't imagine that there wouldn't be a lot of alarms, privacy alarms, go off if we were trying to do that here. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, there are several countries in Asia actually that have done a really good job of contact tracing, but they really have employed the use of technology and having, you know, monitoring of the people's, you know, comings and goings based on, you know, on their phones or having people input various, you know, amounts of data into their phones so that they can track them. The good thing about that is that you're able to utilize that technology to not only, you know, potentially identify cases, but also potentially, you know, obviously contact tracing too, because you want to know, you know, if someone went to this certain place of business, like the caller was mentioning, you know, who was around that place of business at the time, who were they potentially, you know, exposing, that sort of thing. The problem with that is here in the United States, we value our privacy and we come to expect it. And so that's something that will definitely raise some, you know, some alarm with individuals. I do, though, agree with the fact that, you know, our public health system does a great job, but they're overwhelmed with this, especially in places that have lots of cases. And, you know, another reason that we really need to so-called kind of flatten the curve is not necessarily just for the healthcare system or, you know, the ICU beds and that sort of thing, but it's also to help our public health officials do their appropriate contact tracing so that we can stop the spread of this.
Dr. Angela Hewlett with us, medical director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit. She's with us from Omaha. And Dr. Preethi Malani, University of Michigan's chief health officer. And she's with us today from Ann Arbor. Taking your calls and questions on some of these questions about testing and contact tracing. How would it actually work? Do we have the capacity at the moment to do it? How would we employ technology? And then I'd love to hear you on some of your questions or concerns about the idea of opening more businesses in Minnesota and the upper Midwest. Yes, we too are restless here. I'm sure they're restless in Nebraska and Michigan too. But I'd like your sense about how you feel about being able to go back into some of these businesses and, you know, to some degree, do what you were doing before the lockdown, before the pandemic. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, I will get to some of the questions on Twitter. I also want to ask Dr. Malani and Hewlett about drug therapy. We just heard in the news that a drug trial that was going on has been stopped. I was reading something about remdesivir trials going on with that. Why is it so challenging, I guess, to find effective drug therapy? So they may have some thoughts on that.
Back to your
well.
Calls and your questions for Dr. Preethi Malani and Dr. Angela Hewlett.
I'll grab one here from the phones and then we'll get some off of Twitter to Michael in Minneapolis. Hey, Michael, thanks so much for waiting.
Good morning. Thank you for this conversation.
Of course. What do you want to know?
Well, assuming that if you get COVID-19, you are immune, which isn't necessarily proven, but mm-hmm. I think it's sort of assumed in the scientific community. I'm just curious, what is our next step? Like, what is our goal? If we're flattening the curve, it seems like it's just going to prolong sheltering in place. And I'm just curious what you guys have to say about what our next goals are to get stuff open again.
Good. All right. Dr. Hewlett, I think it bears repeating, and I've done this on many of these Mondays, to explain what flattening the curve is. It doesn't stop the cases, right? It stops the urgency at the medical facilities. Will you add something to that?
Sure. Right. So flattening the curve does not necessarily stop the cases. In fact, we don't really expect to see no cases, over this period of time. What we are trying to do is to try to prevent a huge surge in cases that would overwhelm our healthcare facilities, also overwhelm our health departments, as we mentioned earlier, and would make it difficult for us to care for patients. And so flattening the curve just means that we're really trying to buy time. We're trying to buy time until we have an effective therapeutic drug, which, you know, obviously I think we're going to talk about in a little bit the variety of different drugs that are undergoing testing right now. We're also buying time for a vaccine, which we hope will be, will be available sometime possibly in 2021. But mm-hmm. but really what we're doing is to try to not overwhelm our healthcare systems and just to buy ourselves time to try to figure out the best way to treat this and prevent it.
I saw something, Dr. Malani, over the weekend from Dr. Michael Osterholm here at the University of Minnesota, who said we may be in a situation where we're really not going to have gotten a hold on this until, and he gave a statistic like between 40-60% of the population has been exposed or who has had the virus. And I think Michael was asking something along those lines, too. Do many of us really have to have been exposed to this and either never got symptomatic or did get symptomatic and recover to really be able to say we've beat this pandemic?
Yeah, so that's this is one of the major questions we have. And with what we know so far in terms of infectiousness and how many people the coronavirus would transmit to, you would need a large portion of the population to have been exposed. And again, assuming that exposure and prior infection does in fact mean immunity, which I'm gonna just take that at face value
okay.
for the moment.
Yep.
It would mean, and it may be even higher than 60%. And the issue becomes that there are people within the community that are believed to be more vulnerable. We think about older adults and we think about people with other chronic conditions. And, you know, how long can we sort of hold out and, as we talked about, flatten the curve and then hopefully protect some of the people that are most vulnerable? But it's, again, the end game is, as Dr. Hewlett mentioned, you know, hopefully having some therapy that helps even, you know, moderate cases and certainly severe cases. And then eventually, hopefully, a vaccine that can be given safely and can be given in large numbers.
You know, it's kind of a weird thing to consider, though, Dr. Milani, because we're taking measures to try not to get the virus or spread it. And yet, in some ways, that may be what it takes, right? Before we can say, okay, life returns to normal, we have a real hand. You know what I'm saying? You know why that feels so contradictory?
Yeah. I do, and I think there have been a couple countries that initially took that approach, at least from what I have read.
Like the herd immunity, right?
Yeah,
Sweden, I think, too, for
yes,
a while.
Yes, in Sweden, and you know, so far it looks like in Sweden. And in Sweden, I think that there's a sense of personal responsibility. So what I have read is that people are taking some of the precautions. They're just not being mandated. But in England, there certainly was a big uptake. And you know, part of that is preserving the integrity of the health system.
Mm-hmm.
And again, some of the surges we saw in our country, too, in some of the places. And in my state, Detroit, had some difficulties early on with the large volume.
Right.
But, New York, certainly. But it is, and we think, well, is there a way, you know, that maybe it's slowly going through some of these communities and including smaller, younger kids, small children and teenagers and young adults where they just have a tendency to gather more anyway. And we won't know until we have a way to do large surveys on the population to understand what's happened with serology. But it's one more part of COVID that makes it complicated to plan.
For sure. Here's a question on Twitter that I think goes right to this. Dr. Hewlett, Aaron asks, I've been isolating at home with my family since March 16th with only a few trips outside for food and supplies. If I've never had the virus and therefore no antibodies, how safe will I be if I decide to go out more as the state loosens restrictions? This does kind of go right to what we were just talking about.
Yeah, so I would just emphasize that even if your state loosens restrictions, that doesn't necessarily mean that you need to go out for, you know, for trips that are non-essential. And I don't plan on going out for trips that are non-essential. I have been exercising a similar, you know, a lot of us have been staying at home as much as possible when we don't, you know, have to go to work for, you know, our healthcare worker population. But, you know, just because your state has released, or some of the, you know, constraints on businesses does not necessarily mean that it's good to go out. And I think we need to emphasize that to people that, you know, we're not through this. You know, there are some stipulations involved with loosening some of those restraints, particularly with, you know, masking and social distancing, maintaining, you know, a smaller number of people within these businesses and things like that. But I guess I just would advise people to just continue to be cautious. Don't because the regulations are not necessarily all in place anymore does not mean that it's safe to venture out in the community, especially without those precautions that I mentioned.
Okay. Call here from Michelle in Minneapolis. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a follow-up question about the serology
test, sure,
and what they can tell us. I have been isolating at home for over 6 weeks with COVID-19. I have a moderate case.
Oh.
Got scary a couple of times, but not life-threatening. So I'm waiting for that day when I feel like I'm immune and I can go back out into the world. But
right,
scientists the world over are warning against these immunity certificates because they're saying that different people have different levels of the antibody.
Right.
The antibodies confer different levels of protection. We don't know how long immunity lasts. So what on that end, besides the test being not particularly reliable, what can the serology tests tell us about whether we're immune and how long we'll be immune? When will we know this? Do we have an idea of that?
Hey, I'm glad you're all right, Michelle. And you could call in with such a good question. Dr. Milani, we're back to all these unknowns. What about those questions?
Yeah, and Yeah, Michelle, I just want to add my well wishes. I'm glad that you're on the mend. The way things are moving, I expect we will know more. And there are a lot of people who've had illness and documented illness that are, for example, donating their plasma for studies looking at convalescent plasma. And it's going to take time for us to understand. And the issue is it may take us a couple of years to really go backwards and understand what infection meant and whether everyone who had it is truly immune. I will say that, one of the things, and I think about it in a healthcare setting, we wouldn't probably change anyone's behavior in terms of use of protective equipment and all the other safety measures just mm-hmm. because they've had documented infection. They've been in a lot of infections in healthcare workers, and part of that is because they're the ones that are out and about, and part of it is because everyone else is sort of staying home.
Right.
But these are great questions, and I hope if we had this conversation a few months from now, we would have more clarity. But right now, these are all unknown.
Let's do have this conversation a few months from now. Maybe we can answer more of this. I want to ask you both about drug therapy because we heard that the pharmaceutical company Gilead had reported that a clinical trial of remdesivir in a Chicago hospital was actually shortening hospitalizations of people with severe cases of COVID-19. Then we heard on the news right before we started our conversation that Kevzara had a disappointing drug trial. I know there are many, many, Dr. Hewlett, drug trials in effect, but this seems like it's more challenging to even find an effective therapy than some people were predicting at the beginning. And why might that be?
Well, so this is more challenging just because this is a brand new virus. And this is a virus that, although it is similar to the original SARS that, caused infections in China and around the world in 2003, mm-hmm. it's still different enough to, and the fact that we actually never really established a treatment for the original SARS, mainly because the cases just stopped, and they stopped fairly suddenly. And so because of that, there weren't a lot of people to study. So we never really established a good treatment strategy for that disease. And so we're really starting from scratch here with this new virus. And just the process of testing drugs, whether that's for, a drug that treats heart disease or diabetes or anything, is a really lengthy one. And it's lengthy for two reasons. One is, you have to find out if the drug works, number one, and that's something that we're obviously working on now with various clinical trials on drugs to treat COVID-19. But we also want to make sure that whatever we're giving is safe, and that's incredibly important, especially when we're talking about an illness that has infected so many people around the world, because we want to make sure that anything that, that we give to people is safe. And the first, kind of tenet of medicine is do no harm. And so we need to make sure that we're finding these drugs that work in appropriate ways to obviously find something that helps treat this illness, but also to make sure that we're giving it in the right way to keep people safe as well.
Dr. Milani, I assume the same holds for the vaccine development. I heard something the other day, I think it was on a podcast with the New York Times, about the fastest development of a vaccine before this was 4 years to find a vaccine for the mumps. And so when we hear people saying, well, we'll have a vaccine by December, it sounds like we should be skeptical about that. What is challenging about developing a vaccine at this point?
Well, again, mumps was a generation plus ago. So mm-hmm. hopefully some things work in our favor. But there are a number of things. One is just developing a safe and immunogenic vaccine, and particularly for this type of virus, which hasn't been done much. And there are, fortunately, a number of candidate vaccines that are moving along, and there's at least some enthusiasm on this, and people who work in that area feel that it can be done. And then the second part, which is related but important, which is really testing a number of people and how do you test it? Do you look for antibodies? Do you actually do challenges with infection? And there's some discussion around that. These are things that have not really been done before.
Can I ask you what you mean when you said, do we do challenges
yeah,
with infection?
So,
what is that?
So this would be the idea that you would give a vaccine candidate and that you would expose the individual to a lab setting to the coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2, and then you look for illness. And so, you know, again, it's a very different kind of paradigm than what we're doing with, other recent vaccines that have been given, you know, whether it was, you know, things that have been developed in recent years, HPV comes to mind. And this is a whole different kind of vaccine. And one of the interesting things is that there are new methods to deliver the vaccine. And again, I am not that deep into that world, but I definitely read what comes across my desk. And some of it is in just very well-written lay audience literature. But this is a situation, everyone says it over and over, unprecedented, and there is a lot of effort behind this, a lot of coordinated effort. And so although it's not something as simple as like you just cook this up and give it, there is hope that this is going to be a lot faster in terms of a timeline of 4 years. That is not something that I have heard. But I do think it's going to be, you know, perhaps as early as the fall and maybe early in 2021. So it's still several months away in the best case scenario, and that's assuming that it is effective. And effectiveness is not necessarily that you have 100% elimination of infections. Mm-hmm. It might be that you decrease the severity of infections, much like flu vaccine does.
Got it. Call here from Tom in Apple Valley. Hey, Tom, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Last evening, I happened to come across a video on the Spanish flu in 1918. And one of the points that struck me was that in the city of San Francisco, they managed to avoid high fatalities and rates of infection in wave one and wave two. But in wave three of the flu, they thought it was safe to socially interact, and then they were hit not as hard as other parts of the country, but they were hit hard. Mm-hmm. So my question for the panel is, all this talk about relaxing standards, I think it's premature. I think the chance of having a wave after wave of this is pretty high.
Second and third waves, Dr. Hewlett, what can you tell us about that?
Well, so I'll tell you what, I 100% agree with the caller. You know, this is definitely something that we're worried about and that many of us are afraid of, is that, you know, even the areas that are seeing some degree of success with social distancing now, if we start to really relax things, then yes, I mean, we definitely could see second or even third waves. And that was really well illustrated, as you mentioned, in 1918 by many cities who did relax their social distancing. You know, they experienced larger sometimes, in many cases, second waves or third waves, which killed more people than the initial waves did. And so this is something that, you know, we really have to be really careful about this. And when we're talking about consideration of opening things, we have to be very strategic about that. And things are going to look different. This is not, you know, and this actually happened in 1918, where there were cities that celebrated, you know, they, and you also have to remember that this came in the same time as World War One as well. There were other, you know, other things going on in the world. And so there were big celebrations, parades and such, other things that put people in close contact. And no matter what, we really need to not do those things for a prolonged period of time. And I would say, you know, large concerts where people were gathered together, you know, things like that really, really shouldn't happen for a while. But, you know, can we open businesses, smaller businesses in a very strategic way? I think we can do that, but we really just have to be very careful at how it's done and have to make sure that, you know, that we're protecting everybody.
Yeah. I don't know what the state fair looks like in Michigan and Nebraska, but we were hearing our governor say he was iffy about whether the Minnesota State Fair can happen because of what you just said, Dr. Hewlett, gathering so many people together. And that's in August.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, if you think about it, Germany's canceled Oktoberfest.
Yeah, so that's right.
Obviously,
that's right.
you know, I mean, to me, that's a signal that, you know, they are obviously appreciating what's going on with, you know, with this virus and the potential for transmission in large groups of people in a venue like Oktoberfest. And I think we saw that illustrated in New Orleans with Mardi Gras.
Right.
You know, it's been mentioned many, many times in New Orleans that, you know, Mardi Gras occurred kind of before things were really heating up in that area. But it is a venue that brings together lots of people. And whenever lots of people are grouped together, there's a potential for increased transmission and to see another large wave, as the caller mentioned.
I thought I'd try to squeeze Scott in St. Cloud here. Hey, Scott, can you be pretty quick?
Yes. I wanted to know what the difference is between a vaccine and having the virus and then not having immunity. Why would the vaccine give you immunity when catching it wouldn't?
Yeah. What's really the difference, Dr. Milani, between just getting it or getting a vaccine?
Yeah, so, and again, we're still trying to fully understand the immunology, but in general, the vaccine is not going to make you ill, but it will take a portion of the virus, and that would produce immunity without infection. And I think that's where it is tricky. And as to whether they're equivalent or not, none of this is known. But it's everything that I understand is that the vaccine would help eliminate the more severe disease and, you know, hopefully keep people from having significant symptoms.
I just want you both to know how helpful this was. This was just great. I mean, Dr. Milani, thank you so much for the hour. Really nice to have you. And Dr. Hewlett, thank you very much for the hour. I want you to know it means a lot to be able to have two scientists come on and take questions and cover as much territory as we do. So thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Hewlett with us from the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit, where she's medical director, and Dr. Preethi Milani, University of Michigan's chief health officer, and with us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!